look, that's our little joy. Your love is drawing me closer.
To SER's Arts and Culture Show.
Don't make me say so hot right now.
Tan caliente ahora!
Your weekly dose of arts and culture.
And all of that sort of stuff. It's that weird thing that they're classics because they're classics because they're classics, and then they become the classics and everyone wants to do the classics because they're classics.
He's amazing.
Well, you need a lot of room for all that blood.
And he's hot as a firecracker.
You're listening to So Hot Right Now. You better not use me saying that.
Amazing babes.
On 2SER 107.3.
Morning, morning, morning. You are listening to So Hot Right Now with me, Sophie Lai, here on 2SER. It's your weekly dose of arts and culture. And there's no aspect that we leave untouched, from pop culture to visual, performing arts, everything in between. Massive show for you today, and I'm so excited for it. Graffiti with Punctuations, Blake Howard will be joining us for another gaggle of gigs, and we can finally, we're out of embargo and the movie is out. We are going to be talking about the new Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 movie. Also, Packed Salon in Erskineville, they have it's happening tonight, the Big Bounce, and if you into dance, this is an event for you. But most excitingly, renowned Japanese director Akira Kurosawa was the absolute master of action in a film. This year's Sydney Film Festival presented their retrospective Essential Kurosawa, which is selected by David Stratton. Yes, the David Stratton. And he's inviting you to revisit these iconic films. And my producer actually spoke to who I like to call a Sir David Stratton, and that's happening next. But to get you there, here's a tune from our feature album. It is from Mac DeMarco, his fifth album in about 5 years. He just keeps pulling them out. This one is his new album's called This Old Dog. I don't think he's an old dog. Plenty of left in that old dog. It's called A Wolf Who Wears Sheep's Clothes. You're into SER.
Just trying to keep it light. Sometimes casts a shadow. Trouble is keeping quiet, and you know well where your heart goes. Troubles with meeting anybody these days are bringing you down. All predisposed believing in a wolf who wears sheep's clothes. Troubles with meeting anybody, follow wherever you go. All predisposed, believing in a wolf who wears sheep's clothes. Thank you.
2SER will be reporting live from Canberra Tuesday, May 9, to tell you everything you need to know about this year's budget.
How will families fare? What about small business? And how about funding for education, health and the environment?
Tune in to hear the 2SER team's in-depth analysis and independent coverage. Tuesday, May 9 from 7:30 p.m. on 2SER 107.3.
That is Sydney Cider and Nomi, aka Sophie Loiseau. She's a Red Bull Academy alumni who's played with the likes of Flying Lotus, Gaslamp Killer, Teebs, and Code 9, and much, much more. Amazing. Keep your eye out on her on the dance floor because she is killing it. You are listening to So Hot Right Now with me, Sophie Lai. Hope you're having a cracking morning, and it's going to get a bit more cracking. Essential Kurosawa, selected by David Stratton, is a retrospective program screening 10 essential films directed by the great Japanese filmmaker himself, Akira Kurosawa. The curated films are presented by the Australian Centre for Moving Image, the National Film and Sound Archive of Australia, and the Japan Foundation for this year's Sydney Film Festival. Our producer, Nicole Beck, was lucky enough to speak to the curator of the project, iconic film critic. You may know him from David and Margaret. And lecturer and author David Stratton.
What was the first Kurosawa film you saw?
The first Kurosawa film I saw was Seven Samurai, and I saw it probably about 1958. It was made in 1954, and it made a huge impression on me. It's an amazing film, I guess that was also the first Japanese film I ever saw. So it had a double impression, because I suppose when you're looking at films, to see a film from a completely different culture for the first time is quite a challenge sometimes. But Seven Samurai is such a accessible film. I mean, it is very much like a Hollywood Western in many ways. So it was a wonderful introduction to one of the world's great cinemas, Japanese cinema.
You've mentioned the word accessible, and Kurosawa's work is very accessible. Do you think this is why it has been so successful?
Yes, it's partly that, I think, but it's also partly because Kurosawa is such a great filmmaker, and I don't think anybody stages action scenes quite the way he does. There are scenes in Seven Samurai, for example. There's a battle between the bandits and the samurai that takes place in a pouring rainstorm, absolutely driving rain, and just the elemental feel to it all, and the fact that Kurosawa shoots it with very long lenses, so that it sort of kind of looks really striking and unusual. And there's such physicality to it that it's just breathtaking. And I think those sorts of action scenes certainly helped the film find an audience internationally.
And was it this style that set Kurosawa's works apart from other Japanese and international directors of his time?
There were other Japanese directors who were making sort of action films, samurai films, but nobody made them quite like Kurosawa, and it has to do with a lot of different things. The actors he used, for example, Toshiro Mifune, who played the leading role in almost all the samurai films he made, is amazing physical presence, but also the fact that the stories of the Kurosawa films are so, in a way, familiar to Western audiences. I mean, Seven Samurai, the basic story, of course, was reused in 1960 for a Western, The Magnificent Seven. So it completely translates into a Western, literally a Western setting. Throne of Blood, another of his great films, is based on Shakespeare's Macbeth, and so on. So he was very influenced by Hollywood. There's no question about that. He said it himself. And the fascinating thing is that Hollywood then became influenced by him. So that, for example, George Lucas has said that Star Wars was inspired, at least, by a Kurosawa film called The Hidden Fortress, which also has a princess and various situations that are not that far away from Star Wars, except, of course, they're set in medieval Japan.
So for this selection, how did you narrow down just 10 films to screen?
Very, very difficult, because Kurosawa made so many great films. It was partly print availability, because most of these are on 35mm prints. Partly that, but also partly... I think just these are some of the best films he made. I regret that we weren't able to show all of them. I mean, there were certainly two or three that I'd love to have included, which we couldn't. We just didn't have the possibility to do that. But it's a pretty good selection, I think.
And so what is the difference when watching Kurosawa in 35mm?
Well, that's the way it was originally watched. That was the way it was originally seen by audiences in cinemas. I think that's a matter of choice to a large extent. I know a lot of people prefer to, if possible, and it's very difficult these days to see films on 35mm if they can, if they were originally made on 35mm. It's the same sort of argument, I suppose, as vinyl records versus CDs and so on other forms of other ways of listening to music. Personally, I'm not entirely convinced that digital isn't just as good. But I know for a lot of people that would be heresy, and 35mm is the way to go if it's at all possible. And it's pretty hard to do these days.
Mm. Did you have a personal favourite of what you've selected?
They're all great films. I think I don't think I'd like to pick out one in particular. I mean, Seven Samurai, maybe it's because of the first one I ever saw by Kurosawa. Still, I think it's a pretty amazing film. But I don't know. They're all good. I mean, The Hidden Fortress is pretty amazing too. They're all good.
For a younger audience who are yet to discover the works of Kurosawa, where do you think is the best starting point for them?
Well, maybe at the beginning. Rashomon wasn't his first film. I think it was about his 10th or 11th film. But it was the film that introduced him to international audiences when it was shown at the 1951 Venice Film Festival. And it really caused a tremendous impact. And I think Rashomon is intriguing because just the very idea of it is really quite contemporary, I think, although it's a period film. I mean, it's about a trial. A man has been accused of raping a woman and murdering her husband. But it's not a clear-cut case. And there are different witnesses who tell a completely different version of the same events. And so the film shows you those events, but from four different perspectives. And they have a completely different meaning depending on how you see them. So that's a pretty interesting concept. And again, the film is photographed and shot in that very, very dynamic way that Kurosawa made his trademark. So it's a pretty good film. It's not as long as some of the others, too. Some Kurosawa made epics. Seven Samurai is over 3 hours. And so it's, there's a lot of lot to get into some of these films.
Why did you want to present this selection for this year's Sydney Film Festival?
I've done retrospectives for the festival for the last 2 or 3 years. And the way it works is that after this year's festival is over, last year we did Martin Scorsese. Mm-hmm. So after that was over, say probably around about September or something like that, I would sit down with Nishan Moodley, the festival director, and we'd talk about, what should we do next year? And then a lot would depend on the availability of material, especially since the festival likes to show 35mm prints whenever they can. As I said before, that's not so easy to do these days. So it comes down to that a lot. I mean, Kurosawa was certainly one of the names that came up. I mean, there were certainly others, and maybe one of those others will be the retrospective next year. I just hope that people who come along, especially if they've never seen a Kurosawa film before. I know it's it might seem a bit daunting, but once you do, I think you'll be hooked. He's just one of the most extraordinary filmmakers, and there's so much to enjoy from his films.
That There was renowned film critic David Stratton speaking with our producer Nicole Beck about the retrospective series he's curated for this year's Sydney Film Festival, Essential Kurosawa. The films will be screening from the 10th to the 18th of June. Booking is essential and tickets are selling fast. But we'll put all the links and how you can get your hands on those wonderful tickets up on 2SER.com on our show page. Just look up So Hot Right Now. Coming up, though, we're going to be talking with the wonderful Blake Howard from Graffiti with Punctuation, because we can't get enough film critics here, clearly. But to get you there, here's a band that will be joining us on the shores of Australia in a couple of weeks. It is Alalas. They are touring at the moment. This comes from their 2014 Worship the Sun album. This one's called Better Than Mine. And if you're around in 2 weeks, they will be playing at Oxford Art Factory.
People who've been injured in accidents don't get legal advice about compensation because they're afraid of what it will cost. But the truth is, it doesn't need to cost you anything. A specialist injury lawyer could actually fund your case for you. Law Partners is Australia's largest specialist personal injury firm, and it costs nothing to call their local office to get some advice. Call Law Partners on 133 529. Or visit lawpartners.com.au.
2SER sponsors.
UTS is number one, again. Ranked as Australia's number one young university for the third year in a row. Our students agree.
UTS isn't a university that holds on to the past, you know? The future demands that we continue to change, and I'm preparing for a fast-changing future.
Join us for a course info evening. To learn more, go online and search UTS Course Info Night. UTS sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
Thank you.
Bombay Royale, putting a bit of Bollywood flair into your morning. You're here on It's So Hot Right Now with me, Sophie, your weekly dose of arts and culture. But now it's time for...
To the Batmobile. Let's go. Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
Roger. Ready to move out.
Holy smokes, Batman. It's Gaggle of Geeks with...
Blake Howard.
And Sophie Lai.
Good morning, Blake Howard of Graffiti with Punctuation.
Good morning, Soph. Good morning, geeks. Happy Saturday.
Happy, happy Saturday. And it's been a happy week for us because the movie we've been waiting for since last year has finally dropped.
It's finally dropped. Guardians of the Galaxy was out, weirdly, for like Australian fans on Anzac Day. On a day that you want to pause and reflect, you definitely need some Rocket and Baby Groot in your life, which is kind of strange. But it's awesome because it means that we usually get the big Marvel movie of the year before anyone else in the world. So that's pretty awesome. So Guardians of the Galaxy 2.
Yes.
We kick off straight away with our guys having a reputation from the last movie and deciding that they're going to use their clout now as these Guardians of the Galaxy, these heroes for hire, to protect people and do awesome stuff. And they fight this crazy many-teethed octopus at the beginning of the film. And in true style, we completely ignore that and instead have Baby Groot dance around all of the carnage and be awesome and cute and kick everything off. And we're immediately fall headlong in love with all the characters that we loved before.
Absolutely. Now, Blake, you reacted last week to your preview screening of Guardians. Sound a bit like this.
Oh. Oh.
Now, can you finally tell us all what you meant by those four reactions?
Yeah, I did. Look, Guardians of the Galaxy 2 is a very accomplished film, and it is, and some moments in it are really strong. The strong stuff is anything that happens with Yondu. Michael Rooker's character pretty much crushes this across the board. You get to find some deep, dark secrets. You get to find out that he's done some gnarly stuff in the Reaver community, which has caused him to be kicked out by the sort of head of the Reavers, played by Sylvester Stallone, which gives us a cliffhanger freaking reunion, which is amazing. You get to see him and his ship get mutinied, and you get these amazing relationships get drawn out between him and Rocket, which is fantastic. Drax, David Bautista, is like laugh out loud infectiously hilarious through this whole film. Like every time he talks, you're laughing. You can't help it. He's like that. He's just like that person that you just want to laugh at all the time. He's tremendous. And so everything that happens with him and our new empath Mantis, who's introduced, is absolutely outstanding. And Gamora and Nebula, the two awesome daughters of Thanos as we head into the Infinity Gauntlet saga, have some great, like, take sibling rivalry and turn it into an explosive demigod smackdown.
Oh, just...
Which is fantastic. The soundtrack is completely kick-ass and about five times the size of the last one. They spent a bajillion dollars on hits all over the place. But, you know, this is where we might get a little bit spoilerish. There are kind of two villains that are going in tandem in this story. One of them, is our very own Aussie, Elizabeth Debicki, who's part of this techno group who essentially are these perfect golden people who send out avatars, like play video games of avatars and like machinery and go out and fight people, which is awesome.
Yeah.
But the other main villain is actually Ego, Kurt Russell's dad. And I don't think I'm really spoiling too much here because I'm assuming that everyone who's listening to this mostly is kind of seeing the film.
Mm-hmm.
And the story about Peter's lineage and how he came to be a son of Ego and his relationship was really cold. It was really, there's a funny little moment where Kurt Russell sort of is reflecting his memories through this like porcelain museum that he has on his world, his planet.
That was so creepy. And
very creepy. And that's the whole story with these two. It's creepy. It's cold. It's not, it doesn't have the energy or the life of the rest of the Guardians movie. And that doesn't mean that it's not emotional, because even in the peak emotional moments, those moments where you fake that there's an eyelash in your eye 12 times, they really have a lot of life in them for everything outside of this main part of the story.
Yeah.
So my reactions are kind of up and down and a little bit softer and maybe a little bit more muted than what I consider to be a perfect swashbuckling space adventure of the first one. Because that there was a central part of this movie that was really cold. But everything around it was excellent.
Mm.
And it's beautiful, and I would go and see another Guardians movie in a heartbeat. But I just found that central, and maybe it's growing up, I don't know, and I'm ripe to be plucked for daddy issues, usually, in film, so I don't really know what it was, but yeah, it's a very good movie, and I hope you've seen it, and I hope you enjoy it, and if you want to see it again, do, because on reflection, I definitely want to catch it one more time while it's on the big screen, but yeah, I don't know, Soph, I was really soft on that. What about you?
Okay, so I'm not a parent, but for me, it was very similar. Watching it, it's a fantastic, fun movie, fun. But compared to the first one, where you kind of felt so much gravitas towards Peter's and Chris Pratt's character, this one is just oh yeah, that's nice and dandy. And then everything else, as you mentioned, Drax, Baby Groot, Rocket, Yondu, Gamora, Nebula, that you just get so drawn into their storylines. And every time they flick back to Kurt and Chris Pratt, you're just actually go back to the other guys. They were funner.
Yeah.
You felt so much more those poignant moments between Rocket and Yondu. I was like, oh my gosh, this is beautiful. Like, they're bonding. And at the end, I was near bawling, which I didn't cry in the first movie, but I was crying in this one, but I still think the first one had so much more compared to this one.
Yeah, it's a really hard act to follow. I hate comparing sequels to the first ones because they're different kinds of movies.
Yeah.
But the first one, just on a pure energy level, the energy in those scenes with the supporting characters, so to speak, because Chris Pratt's character is kind of the leader of the Guardians of the Galaxy, is Star-Lord / Peter Quill. That part of the story really lacked the energy, the vibrancy, the I can't wait to see what's happening next that the other parts of the story did. And the other parts of the story did so well that I think they definitely pushed the movie and pushed the story and pushed the emotion to that next level that it's kind of still a very accomplished movie. Whereas if they weren't as strong, it could have been a total failure because it was so cold in those bits, but they really, they picked up the slack, so to speak. And I think I don't know whether it was the demand to kind of get through that storyline and move on. At the end of the day, Marvel at the moment, it's tough, right? They're in a bit of a, we can make pretty decent movies, but nothing that will blow people away mode. And the two big ones this year that we really wanted to see if they could get past that was Guardians, which I think is probably a head and shoulders above most of the Marvel middling C-plus movies, and Thor Ragnarok. We're just hoping that these movies later in the series can do more than some of those other films have that we really dig earlier on in the series.
Yeah, it's just because they've succeeded for so long, and now it's you need to surprise your audience, and people are like, what else can you surprise us with?
Yeah, and also not give in to them. Because this is the other thing that I felt a bit, Peter Quill's dad being Kurt Russell makes so much sense that it feels like it was said on 1,000 forums at once. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm just kind of I love me some Kurt Russell, but did we need it? I don't think we needed it. Mm. I don't think that was, I don't know. That's me being really super geek nitpicky right now and going, maybe we shouldn't give people what they want. Maybe cast someone else. Maybe cast someone totally different. Maybe cast, someone who, I don't know.
But that's what made Chris Pratt so lovable in the first one. Everyone's like, who is this guy from Parks and Rec playing bloody Star-Lord? Who is he? And suddenly it was just like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. He's perfect. And it was just everyone was like, oh, this guy's genius.
Dave Bautista, everyone was like, that's such a left of field weird casting moment.
He's a WWE wrestler.
And he's killing the game. He's pretty much every role that he's touched recently has been amazing. And he's been very solid in kind of cruddy stuff. But yeah, look, I hope you enjoyed the hell out of Guardians. I hate to sound negative, but everyone I've talked to, when I haven't walked in the room and gushed, they look like Ralph when Lisa breaks his heart. You can see the moment. They hunch over oh my God, you said that it's okay and not amazing. Well, I'm sorry, like, not every new comic book movie is going to be amazing.
No.
And I think that that's a really good point for us, because there's such great content out there that you need to curate and go, this is amazing, that you can't get too, like, flipped out with everything.
No.
You know, out of this week, I reviewed two what are essentially comic book films on Graffiti with Punctuation, and this is the film I liked least.
Wow.
Out of those two. The other one is M. Night Shyamalan's Split.
Ooh. Ooh.
Which is a tremendous film, which I would recommend you guys checking out my review, because the cat's out of the bag. The cat's out of the bag. This week, he announced that he is finally making a sequel that he's advertising as a sequel to Unbreakable, called Glass, coming out in 2019, starring Bruce Willis, starring Samuel L. Jackson, and also, for those who may or may not have seen it, starring some of the cast of Split, because Split is actually in the same shared comic book universe as Unbreakable.
Oh, dear. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. This has got to get complicated.
Yes. So, look, you know, I hope you enjoy it. If anyone says the first Guardians is not as good as the second, they are smoking crack.
Okay.
The first one is perfection.
Absolutely.
The second one is very good.
Very true. But, Blake, thank you for another gaggle of geeks for this week.
You're welcome, Soph. We're off next week, that's right.
We are off next week, but for everyone who still wants to geek out, it is Free Comic Book Day next week.
Brilliant. So, we'll see you on the streets in a tent.
Yes.
Bless you all.
Yes. Enjoy your free comics. Enjoy geeking out. And Guardians, if you just want
to. And Guardians.
If you want a fun romp. But till then, till a couple of weeks from now, Blake, we'll see you then.
See you then. Thanks, Soph. See you guys.
Blake Howard there from Graffiti with Punctuation. You can read all his reviews on graffitiwithpunctuation.com. Listen back to all our Gaggle Geeks, 2SER.com/Gaggle Geeks, or follow us on Twitter at 2SER or at Blake is Batman. Coming up, though, we're going to be talking about dancing, one of my favourite activities to do, because PAX Salon is coming this evening. But to get you there, here's a tune from Frankie Cosmos. This one's called Dancing in the Public Eye.
My ass is made of velvet and my hips are made of stone. And if you really love me, you will leave me alone. I wanna go dancing.
In the house, cult film classics return to Event Cinemas George Street, May 12, for The Godfather Part 2. Keep your friends close.
I knew it was you, Fredo. You broke my heart. You broke my heart.
Hosted by Seven's Jabba and Quinny from Supernova. Check the full In the House program and grab $13 tickets or $11 for Cinebuzz members at eventcinemas.com.au. Event Cinemas George Street, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
Now, if you're a fan of dancing, whether it's seeing big conceptual performances, learning choreography, or just getting down for a good old boogie with your mates, this event is for you. Pax Hall in Erskineville is presenting the Big Bounce for an evening of live music, live performances, art installations, as well as dance workshops to get your bodies moving and inhibit the joy of dancing. Joining you in the studio now is curator Matt Cornell, Cezo Snot, and dancers Angela Goh and Adam Warburton. Good morning.
G'day.
Hi.
Hello.
Morning.
Oh,
morning.
So many of you. All right, big event tonight, but for you guys, what is it about dancing that just makes you go, whoo?
Maybe I can start because I probably have a more layman's approach. But yeah, so I'm a DJ Cezo's Not, and yeah, I also have a background in philosophy, so I like to think about this stuff. And yeah, I think like a role as a DJ is you're kind of like a socialist entertainer. You're thinking about what's good for the group. And I don't, and you have, you know, kind of a responsibility as like a musical propagandist almost.
Wow.
Well, I don't think it's any coincidence that like a lot of dance culture has come out of, you know, actually like oppressive situations. So, you know, queer culture is very embedded in club culture. You know, there's been a lot of things like, you know, the concept of a block party comes from black culture. In Berlin, you know, they basically built clubs out of rubble after the war. And then raves came out of Thatcher England. Yeah. And I think like it's a way for people to come together and see what's possible for individuals to be themselves in a celebratory kind of way. So it's asking how can we live together and creating new values, because like dancing is something that's more of like a direct intuitive kind of relation to the world. So you aren't getting values from an external authority either. So there's that impetus, even unconsciously, to do that.
So this Pax Salon seems a bit like a bit of a dance festival. So how did it all come about? And, you know, you've got three more events, so what can people expect?
It's true. I have no idea about the future salons, I'm afraid. I was lucky enough to be invited on board to curate this one. And I wanted to open as many doorways and windows and pet doors and cracks in the wall as possible for dancing. Not dance as an institution or as a form or as a construct or a product, but a way of being in the world, which sounds non-practical, but it's actually super practical because the way that you dance informs how you feel about your body and tells everybody else how they are allowed to feel about their bodies. And it's a way to practice hunting or sexual activities.
It is really practical. That's kind of Heideggerian.
Yeah.
He had the idea against like Descartes, like where, yeah, you are practically engaged with the world, and he actually called it being in the world, or Dasein. It was his term. Yeah.
And I also remember my mum, she's getting to an age now where she can't dance the way that her soul wants to, I guess.
Yeah.
But she still gets the pleasure from watching people dance. And so I didn't want it to be only one avenue to engage.
Yeah.
And that's why I invited these artists on board. Maybe Adam maybe can talk about, like, he's really keen on people having access to dance and dancing, and his experience is more in house and the club culture that surrounds house dancing. You want to talk about how that's become a piece? Or
yeah, sure. So I'm really excited, I guess, to be a part of the other night, and I think Matt's put on like a really great event. You know, like, I'm also really excited to hear Cezo's DJ set as well for the night.
Yeah.
I guess I come more from a street dance background, and I also, I guess, create performative works as well, I guess, contemporary dance works as well as performance art pieces as well. And so I think, yeah, the night's really great. Like, how it starts off is there's going to be a dance workshop at the beginning, and I think that's just a really like nice way for people to kind of get inside and being able to dance without having to be inebriated basically or drunk. and it's really refreshing because I feel that everyone always usually goes out and there's this real stigma, especially around men, around dancing. And so I think that's just a really nice entry point for the night. And
do you think it's changing with how people perceive men dancing?
I'd say yes and no. Like, in the media, I guess, if you're looking at those, you know, a lot of the shows that are out now. And I think, you know, I guess the younger generation perhaps are having a different view, but it's amazing still how many times me and my friends or other dancer friends will go out, and then sometimes you'll get guys, you know, drunk and trying to come in and do their thing to and just like make a fool of themselves or to try and put one up on someone else. So there's still, I feel that, yeah, that culture that's still there.
I think it's about where it comes from and how much you feel like you need to defend your social power position. And dancing's this really weird thing where in all of Western culture and our films and our books and our movies, films and movies, yeah, the person in power remains seated, the king or the godfather, whoever it is. They don't get up. They don't get physical because they're in power and they don't have to get physical. And my experience is the opposite. My experience is that when you are dancing, that's when you are in power, because that's when your body is given back to you.
Wow.
And maybe Angela has a totally another take on it. Again, with her,
Piece. Yeah, because you're performing tonight as well.
Yeah, so tonight I'm performing the next iteration of a project that's been going since about 2014. And it's happened in lots of different places, in Sydney a couple of times, and then lots of places elsewhere. And it's the premise of the piece is that for each performance, I hire the services of a professional psychic, and she predicts what will happen during the work. And then during the performance, I make that come true. So this project is kind of looking at dance as kind of its own entity in the world, with that's not a thing to that caters to the desires of a dancer or a choreographer, or just how it can arise, and how then as a performer or as an audience, how we can be with a dance that doesn't necessarily cater to anything else except fulfilling its own destiny. And in that moment, how can then we experience dance as a thing of itself, without having to justify it in any way, or without having to ask of it kind of like, what does it mean? What is it doing here? What's its purpose? And it's because the answer to all those questions is like, it just because it is here. And to give kind of a power back to dance as a thing. And also to kind of circumvent any kind of critique, because whether you believe in psychics or not, it's kind of a closed loop, because I make it come true, so it does come true. So there isn't, it like it can't be critiqued. So in that way, like, how else can we interact with it, or how else can we be with it without not in the mode of critique, but in the mode of kind of more like feeling what it's like to be next to it or something.
Yeah. Do you feel like, particular audience members, they're still a bit inhibited by like, oh, that's a bit too much, I can't do that, and that kind of vibe when it comes to dance?
Maybe I'm going to ask Adam to talk about, because you're doing house dance, mate, which seems like it's not easy to do well, but it's not, it doesn't have the same physical barriers that, say, breakdancing might have.
Mm.
So do you want to talk about if there's stigma about, like, maybe the way that you've constructed your piece so that it feels like something that people might see themselves doing?
Yeah, okay, sure. Well, I guess just taking, like, maybe a wider view of, like, of the question first is, I know, I feel that, like, with audience participation with dance, I feel that it comes a lot down to the people who are in that space and how open they are with their dancing, and just energetically. I know that sounds maybe a bit heebie-jeebie, but yeah, so I guess when I go out a lot with other dancers as well, you can feel it immediately, I feel, when you walk into a space, whether or not it's an inviting place and you feel safe. And I feel that's really important for dance, because dance is such a personal thing. And so I feel if you feel safe, then you're more willing to express yourself and through your body. And so I guess the piece that I've worked on with the two other dancers, Sean Cheng and Paulina Bocian. I feel that I chose these dancers as well because I feel that they have that same energy, that they're quite open as dancers. So I'm hoping that through this work that, yeah, perhaps in the end the audience might feel open enough to join in.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think the like what I hope for the evening is that it's not about us and them.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about the people that have legitimacy to move their bodies and the people who still do not have it. It's not about dance as an object outside of yourself or your culture or your body or your perception. Actually, it's about dancing and that exists and how can you let it exist in your body for the amount of time that it's going to make you feel awesome.
Mm. And sometimes I feel like as a DJ, I try to make that like impossible not to dance.
Yes.
It's like my aim to break down the barriers. And so you really need to learn how to charm people. Yeah.
And how do you do that through music? Like, because you don't know what these people like.
Sure. Just... It's kind of like a pedagogical approach. So like you have to show people what they already know and then lead them through to things that they don't know. So if I like present something familiar, then more likely to feel positively. And if everyone's dancing to it, then they're more likely to dance. So you kind of have to have like, whether like intuitively or not, like knowledge of, I don't know, individual motivations and social pressures and what will make people get up.
It sometimes seems like it works on you yourself. I remember seeing you at gigs where the beats dropped and then you've got up and twerked and ripped the jumpsuit off.
Yeah, I can't really. I think that's also a part of my like way of getting everyone to show them it's okay. Yeah. Yeah. Not that I don't feel it. Yeah.
So will the evening will it be a huge dance party at the end of the night?
What I'm hoping is that you rock up and you learn some tools of dancing with Vanessa Marion and groove therapy, because it's not a routine. It's not something you aim to re-perform. It's like it's a practice. It's a having a go. And then we'll all chill and chat and have a free barbecue so that we're all nourished up to continue to go back in and watch some performances by Adam and by Angela. And then listen to the backstory, like where all these artists are coming from, where they're hoping that they can take us towards. And then, yeah, I mean, I'll just give it away. The curtain's going to drop and there's going to be two cars with their boots open with their subwoofers out the back, and Cesar's going to DJ us into togetherness.
Oblivion.
Oh, yeah. Oblivion, which is the same thing.
Unity.
Which is the same thing.
Unity. I just like had a vision of like Fast and Furious level of subwoofers, just like oops, oops.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I guess you'll have to come.
Actually, that's the soundtrack I'm playing.
Yeah.
Little bitch.
Yes. Fun at times. But it all is happening tonight.
6 p.m.
6 p.m. in Erskineville. We'll put all those details up on 2SER.com. That says Angela, Adam, Matt, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And jump back into the music now. Here's a tune from Step Panther. It's called Candy in the Sky.
Staring in the wrong direction. I got bad reception. I'm absentee. Staring in this time of wonder and human discovery, I'm absentee.
Ominous, furious, and wildly inventive, Colson Whitehead's 2017 Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Underground Railroad, has been lauded by Barack Obama and Oprah Winfrey. Join Colson at Sydney Writers' Festival as he sits down with New York Times book review editor Pamela Paul to discuss his imaginative exploration of the foundational sins of America. May 27, City Recital Hall. Tickets on sale at swf.org.au. Sponsors of R107.3.
Juilliard Ducournau's Raw. The story of a young woman whose lust for life develops into a lust for flesh has been wooing critics and audiences around the world since its debut in Cannes last year. Haunting, powerful, brutal, and erotic. You'll never forget this boundary-pushing, mind-expanding, genre-defying masterpiece. Raw is showing in select cinemas now. Check local guides for details. Monster Pictures, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
My time here is just about up, but thank you for listening to So Hot Now for another week on 2SER 107.3. If you missed any of our podcasts, just head along to 2SER.com and click on the Programs tab. You'll find us So Hot Right Now and listen back to everything there. Big thanks to all our guests, the David Stratton, film critic extraordinaire, talking about Essential Kurosawa. That's happening next, June, not next month yet. Month after. Also to Blake Howard for gaggling of geeking with us and talking about Guardians of the Galaxy. You can also read his review on graffiti with punctuation.com. And to that whole team at PAX Salon, the big bounce is happening tonight in Erskineville. Put all those details up as well on the podcast. But for now, stay, don't go anywhere, because we've got some dubbers in the air with the Gunsman and it's gonna be fun. But here's a couple of messages from our sponsors. But I won't be here next week, but I will see you in a couple of weeks. But till then, bye!
To celebrate the success of 2SER's first ever podcast series, Just Words, we've teamed up with Audiocraft to bring you a live listening event on Thursday, May 18. Our podcast series has gone beyond the hype and headlines of Australia's racial discrimination laws, and you can watch the 2SER team record our final episode of Just Words live as we put 18C on trial and determine if our race hate laws really did murder free speech one last time. Come on down on Thursday, May 18 and listen to a mixture of live and recorded stories as we explore the new frontier of the culture wars. Doors open at 7 p.m. in Redfern at 107 Projects. Be sure to book your ticket now as spaces are limited. To find out more, head to 2ser.com.
Working late? Office party? Or just plain hungry? Crust Piermont is your go-to pizza store in the Sydney CBD. Open from 11 a.m. until late, 7 days a week, Crust Piermont can deliver up to 150 pizzas per order using the best equipment to ensure your gourmet pizzas are delivered fresh, hot